Mira was already regretting having taken such a hard line on the LSD, but she'd given her opinion so scornfully that she didn't feel that she could change it now without losing face. She was embarrassed that by acting aloof and disagreeable, as she always did around Lemoyne, she'd come off instead only like a killjoy and a prude. And she was disappointed, for she'd done mushrooms several times and enjoyed the experience enormously, and she knew that she would have accepted the Ziploc bag with genuine curiosity and interest if the offer had come from almost anybody else. As Shelley passed out of sight below the shelter belt of pines, she scowled and crossed her arms, preparing, with a grim kind of resignation, to double down on a position she had never really held in the first place. Lemoyne was grinning at her.
"I must say, I never picked you for a Puritan," he said. "I'm surprised."
"Well, I guess not everybody's a total fucking cliche," Mira snapped. He grinned wider.
"You don't like to be out of control," he said. "Is that it?"
"Hey, fuck you, I don't have to explain myself to you," she said. "We're in the middle of nowhere. We're like hours and hours from the nearest hospital. Excuse me if I don't want to go on a fucking acid trip with a guy who has yet to put his money where his mouth is, by the way, which means we're basically trespassing already. And I'm sure that the law, like, doesn't exist for you or whatever, but it sure as hell does for all of us. And if anything went wrong, we'd be totally screwed. So yeah, no thanks."
"That's a pretty good explanation for someone who doesn't have to explain herself."
"And I'm not a Puritan," Mira said. "I'm just not a total fucking idiot."
"Or a cliche," said Lemoyne.
She glared at him. "So now you're going to tell me how actually I am a cliche. I just don't realize it, right?"
"Not at all," he said. "I was just going to remark that being a cliche can be very useful. You ought to consider it sometime."
"Oh yeah?"
"Yeah," he said. "It means people underestimate you. They think they've seen all there is to see. They drop their guard. They get lazy. They reveal themselves."
"Thanks for the tip," she said. "But I'm a woman. I'm underestimated like every day of my life." He laughed.
"Good answer," he said. "But I don't believe it for a second."
"You know, we've actually been working pretty hard here," Mira said. "We've been taking this pretty seriously. This isn't like a holiday for us. We've been working our butts off."
"I'm sure you have."
"So maybe before you drop your tab of acid tonight, we could actually put some stuff down in writing. Like, draw up a contract or something. Just so we can be sure you're not stringing us along." He said nothing, gazing at her thoughtfully. "See, this is what I'm worried about," Mira said. "I'm worried this is just a bit of fun for you. Like, it doesn't really mean anything. Whereas for us, this is like our livelihood. Like, I realize that you've probably made $100,000 in capital gains just while we've been standing here, but—"
"You're right," he said, cutting over her. "I have been stringing you along."
She faltered, not understanding.
"This is a rare experience for me," said Lemoyne. "This—"
He gestured at the space between them.
"I've been wanting to enjoy it. Draw it out."
"Right," Mira said uncertainly. "For sure."
"But yes," he said. "Let's get something down in writing. Good idea."
Mira was starting to feel embarrassed again. "Just for our peace of mind," she said. "I mean, I don't think you'll be disappointed when you see what we've been doing."
"Oh no," he said briskly. "I don't think I'll be disappointed."
But she was blushing now. She felt that she had misjudged him, that she had failed to trust him, that she was in the wrong. He had been keeping a window of possibility open between them, and she hadn't seen it, and she'd slammed it shut. Abruptly, he said,
"I changed the code on the front gate."
"What?" she said. "When?"
"This morning," he said. "It's now 7172. I added one to every digit."
She drew back. "Hey," she said in a tone of offense. "It's lucky we didn't need the van today. We'd have been locked out."
7172, he said again. "It should be easy to remember."
Mira could feel her embarrassment becoming scorn again. "It's kind of weird you changed it before telling us," she said. "When we're the ones living here. That's kind of fucked up, actually." He stared at her for a moment without blinking. Then he said,
"When my wife died, Mira, I had paparazzi at my front gate for a year. If I came out of my house, If I even opened a window, they'd yell at me, "You knew about that helicopter, didn't you? That's why you stayed behind that day. You let her go on purpose because you wanted to be rid of her." They'd say, "Was it murder or was it sabotage or I don't know. Is it true you used to beat her up?" Of course not. Every allegation was utterly false and utterly obscene. But that was the point, you see. They were trying to make me angry, because if I react, that's their story. And they're not breaking any laws. They're only asking questions. That's their job. They even used to say, "Is it true she's still alive?" How cruel is that? To a man whose wife is dead. And there was no basis for it. No justification. Nothing. It was just a question. And you can't stop someone asking questions, can you? Mira was appalled. "God," she said. "I'm so sorry. That's horrendous."
"So I don't think much of journalists," he said. "Needless to say."
"I can't even imagine. Jesus."
"I have to take certain precautions."
She was blushing again. "Yeah," she said. "Of course."
"And when Burnham Wood goes live," he shrugged. "Well, anyway, I've already said it. I have been stringing you along. I have been enjoying this, our little back and forth. And the privacy, the calm before the storm. But you're right. It's got to be about the work."
He smiled at her a little sadly and gestured down the hill.
"Shall we head down?"
He had never spoken of his wife to her before. He had never spoken about any of his relatives, in fact, or any of his associates, or any of his friends. Perhaps he was starting to trust her, Mira thought, with a kind of fearful gratitude, as they set off down the slope, and he changed the subject back to Burnham Wood, asking about the health of the crops and the planting schedule and the weather. She noticed how he scanned the fields in front of them very closely as they walked, and she felt a surge of pity for him, and then shame that she had endured nothing in her own life that could possibly compare with what he'd gone through. The sun was setting by the time they reached the shearing shed, where they found Aaron and Jessica lighting hurricane lanterns, and Hayden chopping kindling for a fire. The ingredients that Lemoyne had bought for dinner had been lined up in their containers next to the barbecue, ready to be thrown together and fried. And inside the shed, Shelley and Katrina and Natalie were setting the table for dinner, though it was not really a table. It was an old door they'd found propped inside the shearing shed and had placed on a pair of oil drums that they'd part filled with gravel so it wouldn't move. The setting looked charming in the candlelight. Mismatched crockery and camping cookware laid around an extravagant homemade centerpiece of toto and harakiki flowers. And when Mira glanced at Lemoyne to gauge his impression, she saw with relief that he was smiling.
"I like what you've done with the place," he said.
"Probably a bit posher than you're used to," Shelley said. "But hey."
"I only hope I'm not underdressed," said Lemoyne.
"You are a bit," Shelley said. "But we won't hold it against you." It occurred to Mira that she was flirting with him. She looked around for the open bottle of wine that would explain the high color in Shelley's cheeks. It was on the table, already half empty. She looked again at Shelley and saw with a little jolt that her friend was looking back at her. Clearly, she had caught Mira looking at the bottle. Mira tried to smile at her, but Shelley turned away.
"We were just talking about your costume parties," Natalie said.
"Oh, yes," said Lemoyne. "Very famous."
"We saw a picture of you as a clown," said Katrina, "with a graduation cap."
"What was the idea, like clown college?" Natalie said.
"We couldn't figure it out."
Mira wasn't following.
"What are you talking about?" "It's a tradition at Autonomo," explained Lemoyne. "We have a costume party every year at Halloween. Silly, really. But it's become a thing now. Every year it's bigger and bigger."
He turned back to the others.
"That was a good theme that year, actually," he said. "It was stations on the London Underground. I was Oxford Circus."
"Oh," the others all chorused, laughing. "That's such a good theme for a party," Shelley said. "King's Cross," said Natalie. "Paddington, Hammersmith, there's so many good ones."
"Elephant and Castle," said Lemoyne. "That was the winner, I recall."
"And the winner gets, like, a 5-star holiday or something, right?" Shelley said. "It's like a huge deal."
"It's excessive," said Lemoyne. In fact, to be perfectly honest with you, the whole thing is a little out of control.
No, don't say that, Shelley said. It's great.
She was flirting with him. And now she was avoiding Mira's gaze.
Several Victorias that year, of course, said Lemoyne. And a very good Napoleon, for Waterloo.
What were some of the other themes? Said Katrina.
Oh, let me see, said Lemoyne. Last year was... Oh, yes, it was Bob Dylan lyrics. I went as the world's biggest necklace. Except a couple of other people had the same idea, and it turns out I wasn't the world's biggest. Theirs were bigger than mine. That was all a bit embarrassing.
I bet there were lots of leopard skin pillbox hats, said Katrina.
There were indeed, said Lemoyne.
I would have gone as... What's the line? Fog and amphetamines and pearls? Fog is a good costume. It's just fog.
Yeah, like, what are you supposed to be? Oh, me? Just fog. Rubik's Cube, said Lemoyne. That was another year. You come wearing 6 items, in all the colors of the sides of the Rubik's Cube. And the rule is that by the end of the night, you have to be dressed in all one color.
Oh my God, said Shelley, as she refilled the plastic camping mug she was using as a wine glass. That's also so good. I'm totally going to steal these.
Lemoyne was watching Mira.
You're seeing me differently now, he observed.
She was surprised to hear it said so plainly.
I guess I am, she said.
A wee bit.
I don't seem like a costume party kind of guy. Don't worry, it has been said before.
But it was more than that. It was how normal he seemed, how relaxed, how comfortable, how ordinary. She was almost ashamed to admit that he seemed fully human to her for the first time. Like a man with preferences and habits, someone whose experiences had shaped him, who had been both lucky and unlucky, who had a family and memories and a past. Someone who was flirted with, she thought, who existed for other people, who was thought about by other people, who was conjured privately in other people's minds. He was waiting for her reply.
I'm having that weird experience, Mira said at last. Well, you realize that your search engine has, like, led you to this very specific, tailored place based on what it's decided about you. And there are things that are fully searchable to other people that are totally invisible to you. Because I have definitely never seen this Oxford Circus photo of you. And I have Googled you a lot.
He grinned at her and winked. Mira could see in her peripheral vision that Shelley had caught the wink, and she looked at her, meaning to smile and try to share the joke. But again, Shelley turned away.
I wish Halloween was a bigger deal here, Katrina was saying. It doesn't make any sense. It's the wrong season. It doesn't get dark till like 9 p.m, and there are no pumpkins or falling leaves or anything.
Yeah, it's not scary, Natalie said. It's springtime.
People don't get it either, said Jessica, who had just come in.
I went trick-or-treating once in primary school, and nobody knew how it worked. It was so embarrassing saying to your neighbours, well, here's the deal, you're supposed to give me lollies just because I decided to dress up, and if you don't, I'm going to trash your house.
Like basically a hostage situation, Aaron put in.
And nobody had any lollies in the cupboard either. They'd go and look and they'd come back with like a piece of fruit or a biscuit. It was a total disaster.
Hey, man, said Aaron to Lemoyne. Thanks for the acid, by the way. Tumeke. Tumeke, said Lemoyne. Yeah, like, hard out. Hard out, said Lemoyne.
Jessica was laughing.
You totally just used one Kiwiism to describe another one, she said to Aaron.
Tumeke is like, thanks, in the sense of, you didn't have to do that. Above and beyond.
And hard out is like, impressive, Jessica said. Like, awesome, I'm impressed.
It's a real cultural exchange, Lemoyne said.
And they all laughed.
Mira's going to sit it out,
Shelley said suddenly, her voice loud and brittle.
But is everybody else keen?
It seemed that everybody was. I wouldn't say no to some wine, though, Mira said, trying to catch Shelley's eye for the third time. But it was Katrina who picked up the bottle and handed it to her.
So, tonight we party, said Lemoyne. And tomorrow we talk business, yeah?
But didn't you say the acid is kind of like business too? Shelley said. You said it's like a bonding exercise.
Yes, I'm afraid that's a bit of a Silicon Valley cliche, Lemoyne said, with another wink at Mira. But it can be an amazing tool. I think of it a bit like how 50 years ago the cigarettes were on the shelves and the condoms were behind the counter, and now it's the other way around. It'll be that way with psychedelics and alcohol, I'm sure. It'll flip.
As if to register her dissent, Mira drank deeply from her jar of wine. She could feel that Shelley was watching her, but this time she was the one who avoided Shelley's gaze. The conversation turned to the benefits of microdosing, and she excused herself to go and light the barbecue. The voice that she was hearing in her head was Tony's.
All this self-optimizing, self-actualizing bullshit, she imagined him saying as she crouched down to open the valve on the gas tank,
and then pressed the ignition switch until it clicked.
You can't fucking get away from it. Every little thing now has to be about maximizing your potential and perfecting yourself and honing yourself and getting the best deal out of your life and out of your body and out of your precious fucking time. Everything's a corporate retreat now. Everything has utility. You want to get fucked up and just escape your own existence for once? Just check out of your life for a while, like every other human being who has ever lived? No. Even a fucking acid trip has to be a means to an end. It has to be about team building. It has to be about trust and wellness and creativity. It has to be about your authentic journey towards physical and psychological perfection. It has to be about you asserting the integrity of your choice to do it in the first place. There can't be a lapse of judgment. There are no lapses of judgment. It can't be wrong. There are no wrongs. There's just choice, and choice is neutral, and we're neutral, and everything is neutral, and everything's a game. And if you want to win the game, then you're going to have to optimize yourself, and actualize yourself, and utilize yourself, and get the edge. And God forbid that you should have an actual human experience of frailty, or mortality, or limitation, or humanity, or of the fucking onward march of time. Those are just distractions. Those are obstacles. They're defects. They're inconveniences in the face of our curated, bespoke, freely fucking chosen authentic existence. And sure, we can never quite decide if we're the consumers of our lives or the products of them. But there's one thing we are damn sure of, which is that nobody on earth has any right to pass any judgment on us either way. Freedom in the marketplace. It's the only thing that matters. It's the only thing that exists.
They were talking about social media when she returned. I reckon there's a huge rejection coming, Jessica was saying to Lemoyne. Like what you said before about condoms and cigarettes. It'll be like smoking while pregnant or something. Like, there's going to come a time when we won't even be able to believe that we spent so much time online and we didn't know how terrible for us it was.
No way, said Natalie. The opposite. This is what nobody's going to believe.
She gestured around. Meeting up in person, actually having conversations face to face.
So, we're just getting started, in other words, said Aaron.
More social media, said Natalie, nodding. More internet, more virtual, more digital, just more. It's a part of the culture now. It's the way people think. I mean,
she pointed at Hayden, who was turning his wireless speaker on with one hand and selecting a playlist on his phone with the other.
Oi, Hayden, said Katrina. You're being used as an example.
Biohacking, said Hayden, looking up from his devices. That's the next thing. Like where people microchip their hands so they can unlock their cars or whatever just by waving. That's already happening.
And we'll be like uploading our memories to the cloud.
Not just uploading them, changing them.
Putting filters on.
Yeah, we'll basically merge with our phones.
Like a Black Mirror episode.
Let's face it, Natalie said. That show is essentially a documentary.
Shelley was watching Lemoyne. What do you think? She said.
There was a lull as they all turned to look at him.
Well, he said, rubbing his chin. The first Reformation followed the invention of the printing press. One would expect something similar to follow the invention of the smartphone.
Shelley frowned. Like a revolution.
Lemoyne shrugged.
You're the activists. You tell me. Boo, said Hayden. Come on, make a prediction. That's all anybody ever wants from me, said Lemoyne. Predictions.
He smiled across the centerpiece at Mira.
But like, a second reformation? What would that even look like? I mean...
It's all beside the point anyway, Jessica cut in.
We talk about the future like we're going to be here to see it. We'll all be dead. We'll be so fucking dead. We'll be on fire.
Or underwater, sea levels.
Or dead in a plague.
This conversation is bumming me out, Hayden said. Can we do drugs now, please?
Shelley produced the Ziploc bag, and they began to discuss dosages and timing, and what kinds of effects they could expect. Mira went outside again to check the barbecue. She took her time fussing over the wok, trying to find a level place on the grill to balance it. And then she sensed movement behind her and glanced up to see that Lemoyne had come out of the shed and was standing, hands in his pockets, in the shadow of the wall.
I'm going to pass, he said. Keep you company.
You don't have to do that, said Mira.
It's fine, he said. And trust me, I know what it's like being the only sober person at a party.
She couldn't resist. So it is a party? He smiled and put his hand over his heart.
Darling, it wouldn't be without you.
She felt angry with him suddenly. You really don't have to sit it out, she said. I can take care of myself, like really. Go and have your corporate team-building experience. I honestly don't care.
I'd rather be with you, he said.
They were both quiet for a second, and then Mira said, Can I ask you something? If it's too personal, just tell me to... She glanced at him, trying to read his expression in the dim light. I guess I was just kind of curious why you decided to learn how to fly. He didn't move.
Because of how Gisella died, you mean?
Yeah, Mira said. It was strange to hear him speak her name. I wondered if it was your way of dealing with... She lost confidence. I mean, it's totally none of my business. Lemoyne was quiet again. Inside, someone shrieked, and someone else gave a shout of laughter, and there was a sudden blast of bad and bougie as someone cranked the volume way up. The containers of food beside the barbecue were vibrating with the beat. At last, Lemoyne said,
My grandmother, the woman who raised me, was not a well person, mentally. She was an alcoholic, very changeable, very deceptive, a shapeshifter. You never knew where you stood with her, whether she was going to be up or down. She was institutionalized from time to time, later on. And one of the activities they encouraged at the mental hospital was building miniature dioramas. Because everything's so small, you see, it's manageable. You hold the figures in your hand, you can see the whole scene, you have perspective. It's a kind of therapy.
Right, Mira said. That makes sense.
Well, he said, when you're flying, that's another way of making everything seem small.
Mira nodded down at the container of tofu. With her finger, she flipped the plastic latch open and shut in time with the music. She had an odd premonition that he was just about to cross the space between them and come and kiss her. But when several seconds passed and he said nothing, she looked up and saw to her disappointment that he had already gone back in. She felt foolish and started opening the containers, ready to cook. Inside, she could hear that they were dividing up the tabs of acid, and someone must have offered one to Lemoyne because she heard him say,
Not for me. I'm going to keep Mira company.
And then Shelley said, again in that loud, brittle voice,
Oh, is that what people are calling it these days?
There was a lull underneath the music. Mira imagined that they all must have turned to look at Shelley, for after a second, she laughed in a way that was unnatural to her and said,
Sorry. Were we pretending we didn't realize what was going on here?
Okay, Jessica said firmly. I think we should probably have dinner now. Then Lemoyne said in a cool, clear voice,
Do you have something that you want to say?
He could only be addressing Shelley. There was another lull. Mira stood in the dark, astonished, mouth open, waiting for Shelley's reply.
I guess I'm just a little worried that we might be doing this for different reasons, Shelley said at last.
But that's life, isn't it? Said Lemoyne, speaking lightly. Everybody always has their own reasons for doing what they do. You can't police motivation.
No, I know, Shelley said quickly. I know that.
Are you sure? Said Lemoyne.
Shelley, somebody put in, this is kind of none of your business.
Shelley laughed in that unnatural way again. Her face would have reddened, as it always did when she was drinking. There would be a dangerous light in her eyes.
It kind of is, though, she said. I mean, it's pretty clear you guys want to bone each other.
Several people spoke at once.
Shelley!
Hey, stop! Come on, leave him alone! And I guess I'm just a little worried, Shelley said, cutting over them. Like, where does that leave the rest of us?
Mira was straining to hear Lemoyne's answer, but evidently he hadn't felt the need to make one. Hearing nothing, she pictured him shrugging, pictured his expression, taunting, unruffled, lazily amused. Shelley would be appealing to the others, still half-smiling, holding out her palms, perhaps, to suggest an open question. But Mira could hear that they were already changing the subject, trying to apologize, trying to laugh it off. And soon Natalie said, "Where is Mira anyway?" And Jessica said, "She's cooking. We should probably go help." And seconds later, they'd come out of the shed with bright, smiling faces and anxious eyes. And Mira was smiling back at them, pretending that she hadn't overheard, that she'd been in her own little world, that she was none the wiser. Though she knew that they could tell she was pretending, and it was clear to her that they could tell she knew. Over dinner, Shelley said nothing at all. She and Mira were seated at opposite ends of the table, but on the same side, so Mira only saw her profile whenever she leaned forward over her plate to take a bite. The others seemed to be conscious of needing to preserve the space between them, for nobody made any effort to draw either of them into the discussion, which centered, as far as Mira was aware, on the differences between the generations. As they ate, she heard Natalie teasing Lemoyne that Gen X's named their pets like they were children, and named their children like they were pets. And she heard Katrina saying that she'd never felt the definition of millennial applied to her, and Jessica replying that that was the most millennial thing Katrina could possibly have said. And when the conversation turned, as it so often did, to all the many ways in which the millennials had been shortchanged, she heard Lemoyne remarking that he didn't understand why people their age were so nostalgic for the welfare state, since their parents, the baby boomers, were themselves such a good argument against it. Look what happened when you gave people too much help. They just took it all for granted, and then they took it away from everybody else. She could hear herself laughing and protesting and begging to differ and taking a stand. But it was as though she was sitting outside her own experience somehow, participating only through a gauze. And it was only when someone said, "Oh, shit," and they all began to laugh one by one around the table, that she remembered they had taken acid and realized that it must be starting to take effect. And then Lemoyne caught her eye across the harakeke flowers and made a movement with his head that meant, "Let's get out of here." And Mira felt her stomach drop. Dumbly, she got up from the table to see that Shelley was looking over at her with a weirdly teenage expression, a mixture of injury, defensiveness, and scorn. Lemoyne was making their goodbyes. Mira held Shelley's gaze a moment longer, her expression cold, then turned her back on her and left. Lemoyne followed her out into the darkness and around the vanette, which was parked at an angle to provide a kind of windbreak for the barbecue. And neither of them spoke as he fell into step beside her. So afterwards, she could not remember if she had taken his hand, or if he had taken hers. It took them almost 20 minutes to walk back up the hill to the house, which was dark and cold, and had the soapy, indefinably foreign smell of someone else's family.
"God damn it," said Lemoyne, as he let them in with a key. "I forgot nobody has central heating in this fucking country."
He went ahead to find the controls for the heat pump. Mira unzipped her jacket in a show of patriotism, then changed her mind and zipped it up again. She came into the doorway of the living room just as the louvers on the heat pump opened, and it began to blast hot air into the room.
"Jeez," she said. "I reckon it's colder in here than it is outside."
"Yeah," he said. "I should have turned this on before we went down for dinner."
Mira said nothing, wondering if that meant he had always expected the evening to turn out this way. Then she wondered if she had always expected the evening to turn out this way, and she blushed to realize that she had. Her heart was beating fast. She felt as though she had become suddenly bodily, suddenly animal, suddenly incarnate. She could feel her pulse in every part of her, in her groin, in her stomach, in her mouth.
"There's got to be another heat pump," said Lemoyne. "This is ridiculous."
He left in search of it, and Mira looked around at the Darvish's darkened living room and sighed. She turned on a lamp, but the curtains were all open. And as the moon had not yet risen, the picture window reflected her image back to her in perfect clarity. She winced and turned it off again. Instead, she moved to the window and looked out past her reflection into the dark. Then she froze. There was a car at the gate. Its lights were off, and she couldn't tell if anyone was inside,
But from the way it was parked, with the driver's door close to the keypad, it appeared as if the driver had pulled in, meaning to input the code and enter.
Robert?
She said. He didn't answer.
Robert?
Mira said again louder. He reappeared in the doorway.
What?
He said. She pointed through the glass. There's someone at the gate. In an instant, he was at her side and peering down through the glass.
I don't recognize the car, he said. Do you?
You changed the code, she said. He got his phone out.
Shit, he said. Someone tried the intercom 20 minutes ago.
Maybe it's a neighbor, Mira said. Maybe someone heard the music. He was tapping at his phone.
But where are they now? He said, almost to himself. Did they come over the gate?
He was keeping his phone angled away from her, but Mira could see it in the dark reflection of the glass. And she realized that he had opened an app that gave him a bird's eye perspective on the farm. A live feed, it seemed like. Somehow, it had never occurred to her that he might be keeping the farm under surveillance. She opened her mouth to say something, but she was distracted when he scrolled past something that was moving. And then in the next instant, she heard the roar of an engine revving painfully in a low gear. Stupidly, she looked down at the SUV at the gate, but it was still stationary, its windows still dark. And then, before she had time to speak, the Vanette came careening past the house and down the hill.
What the fuck? Mira said as it disappeared from sight. Who was driving that?
Lemoyne was already running out of the room. Mira heard a thud and a screech of tires, and then a crack. She turned and followed Lemoyne out of the house and ran to the crest of the hill to see that the Vanette had swerved off the gravel drive and crashed into a tree. She skidded down the slope, feet slipping on the dewy grass, and even from a distance she could see that the bonnet was steaming, and she could hear the bing, bing, bing of the indicator and the swish of the windscreen wipers, though it wasn't raining, and it hadn't rained all week. And then she saw Shelley stepping down out of the driver's seat, looking utterly bewildered. And in the red wash of the taillights, she saw a body lying in the drive. A man. Unmoving. Pelvis twisted. One arm flung out. The other bent across his chest. And she broke into a run. But before she was close enough to recognize him, before she saw the color of his hair and the shape of his skull, and the mouth that was hanging blackly open, and the eyes that were staring dull and white. Before Lemoyne caught the back of her jacket and pulled her sharply back, folding her tight against his chest, the closest she had ever been to him, the first time he'd ever put his arms around her. Before Shelley sank to her knees and made a strangled sound, before she was even sure the man was really dead, she knew, with sick, guilty, hideous conviction, that it was Owen Darvish. That Owen Darvish had surprised them. That Owen Darvish had unexpectedly come home.